This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Now we're going to keep on our aging theme and hear about aging and developmental disabilities and aging caregivers. We're going to hear from Dr. Tamar Heller, who is a distinguished professor in the Department of Disability and Human Development at the University of Illinois in Chicago, who directs the Institute on Disability and Human Development and is the Rehabilitation Research and Training Center on Family Support, and serves as the co-principal investigator. She directed DHD and the RRTCs on developmental disabilities and health and developmental disability and aging. She has 270 publications and 6 books that focus on family support and bridging aging and disabilities. She was the Association of University Centers on Disability president, the International Association for Scientific Study of Intellectual and Developmental Disability Executive Committee member, and the co-founder of the Sibling Leadership Network. Welcome, Dr. Heller.
Hello. So we know that aging has become continues to be a big topic with the continuing increased life expectancy. And of course, with a little blip around the COVID time, but overall, there's been a big increase. So I'm going to cover a bunch of different areas and to give kind of a broad picture of sort of what it looks like in terms of aging and the supports out there as well. So we'll talk about health and healthy living, about long-term service supports and families, retirement, end-of-life care, and then bridging aging and IDD. For short, I'm using IDD for intellectual and developmental disabilities. So taking a lifespan perspective, we really need to think about this as a whole lifespan issue. We know that what happens earlier in life affects later in life. And these are some of the things in the later life transition that we need to think about. Certainly the development of chronic health condition, the changes in family, caregiver, and support, what happens in terms of retiring from employment and receiving end of life care. So these are some of the major life stages. So what do we mean by aging well? You know, you've heard about aging successfully, but what does it mean? When people already, you know, often they say aging successfully is aging without a disability. What does it mean if you've already had a disability? And given the context of ableism and ageism, some people talk about compulsory usefulness. We often blame people if somehow they don't age successfully, that maybe they didn't do the right health behaviors, etc. So we're going to talk about what that all means for people with IDD. And how do we think about aging well? Well, living on your own terms, you know, what do people want? They say as you get older, you get more and more like yourself and more different from other people. So if you like being alone, you'll want to continue being alone. You want to add value to society, family, or friends, and of course, maintaining health and function. So we did a bunch of interviews with people with IDD to really see what does growing older mean to them. So these are just some examples. It means that you are settled and know what you are doing. I am more kinder. I get along a lot better. I have friends I'm happy with and what I do things with. For the future, I wish that I keep going happy and that I don't feel old and that I'm not in a wheelchair. What does getting older mean? I feel people 50 years and older have the same chances as younger people have and more, especially people with disabilities. Finally, I feel older people with disabilities shouldn't let their age or disability stop them from getting the job of their dreams or having fun. So when we started working in this area, We developed what's called aging, engaging with aging, person-centered planning for later life. And we saw that people didn't really understand about aging and life stages. They would tell us things like, you die or you get gray hair, but didn't really understand. So using life stories was a very effective way of working and having them understand what their life is like. Very embedded in self-determination and rights and choice making. Some, especially older people, haven't had many chances to do that. Taking care of their health and thinking about where they live and how to develop friendships and community supports, not just the family. Looking at volunteering and free time options. That was actually the biggest thing that happened as terms of that training. Some end of life planning and really looking at review and goal setting. So that's kind of where we started as we looked at some of these issues. And what were the key aspects was trying to increase the understanding of aging in context, looking at self-determination and choice making, which of course now you really hear so much about it. We started this actually in the early 1990s. To increase the awareness of potential activities and actions and using problem solving and action planning. So starting with health, and we heard a really good presentation for Down syndrome and health just before this. First of all, we know that people with IDD generally have poor health and earlier age-related conditions. We heard about dementia just before. Osteoporosis, often because of the medications that people are using, especially against epilepsy, oral health, and often that really poor health can affect cardiovascular, higher rates of diabetes. And we've also seen higher rates of falls. These are just some examples. There's a lot of research about some of these health issues. Similarly, we have poor health behaviors. We have a lot of obesity generally in this country, but especially it's even higher for people with IDD, especially those who live at home. A lot of sedentary behavior, unhealthy diets. People may have kind of strange diets where they have the same thing all the time, or they can't afford the healthier food. And all that affects, obviously, the health-related quality of life. I think a really big area is access to healthcare. Not everyone gets the good healthcare that we just heard about at the University of Pittsburgh or that you get at the Adult Down Syndrome Center that Brian Chicoine works at. There is a really issue of diagnostic overshadowing. There's a project right now at Rush University that Sarah Ailey's running that focuses on diagnostic overshadowing. And what they talk about is there's a diagnosis of cancer at a later stage, undetected vision and hearing impairments, and difficulty communicating symptoms. I heard someone a few years ago talk about someone who had severe behavior problems and turned out it was a severe constipation issue and just couldn't really communicate about it. Polypharmacy. People can be on 13 different medicines. And we find that deaths are amenable to healthcare intervention. There was one study actually that found that. During COVID, there was a lot of issues about the lack of testing and treatment around COVID. So what are some of the strategies, which I want to emphasize some of the practical aspects. Certainly greater knowledge about impairment and treatments. If people don't know, like the kind of information we just heard about, they often don't know, and often health professionals will tell you that they really don't know. I've heard, for example, physicians and other health professionals say, "Oh, these people don't feel pain the same way." I don't think that's really true. Certainly, reduction in poverty and unhealthy environments—that's a little harder for us to deal with. Improved health behaviors through health literacy and health promotion. Improved access, accessibility, equity, and effectiveness of healthcare. And of course, we just heard about the importance of good kinds of, especially geriatric kinds of assessments. And certainly you'll end up with better health and fitness, or certainly it helps for that. So here's some examples of interventions. The one that I'm most associated with is Health Matters, which is exercise, nutrition, health education curriculum for people with DD. I will talk more about that one. Living Well with a Disability is one out of the University of Montana that's more general to people with disabilities, but they also had a sample of people with IDD. And then We Walk is a newer one that's out of our shop. And this one involves both the family caregivers and the people with disabilities in terms of a walking program to help. So these are just some examples. There are others. So I will tell you a little bit about the Health Matters program. First of all, it's considered evidence-based by ACL. So it's really, I think the only really IDD one that's considered evidence-based, because we've done years of research on this one. But it includes an hour of health education classes 3 days a week, 36 interactive classes, has personal notebook. There's a whole curriculum that originally was done in person. And here you can see kind of the conceptual model behind it. We worked with the Roybal Center, which is an aging center, a National Institute on Aging Health Center, and used a lot of the same thinking and the same kinds of measures that we redid, and using this also model of behavior change, where, you know, first you've got to decide you want to do it. And so you have contemplation, preparation, action, maintenance, et cetera, and then relapse and how to do that. So we all know about people, you know, we do exercise programs and then we stop. So it really takes all this into account. So what are some of the aims? One is to increase the understanding of aging in context, which I actually talked about before. The choice-making aspect is really important of what people want to do and what they like to do. To increase the awareness of potential activities that people can do and the use of problem solving and action planning. That's all very important. The other piece that we feel is really important is how do you sustain health promotion programs? So you need a supportive environment. So much of what we do is in the community-based organizations, and to be able to do this, so it really is sustained. So you need policies supporting health and safety, and supportive attitudes among staff and management for it. So we had the efficacy trial with randomized design. Here's some of the findings that we had. More exercise knowledge of the people with IDD. They had more confidence in their ability to exercise. In the beginning, they would come in and not know what to do and how to use any of the equipment. Greater life satisfaction, which is really interesting. Obviously better fitness, and the caregivers had more positive perceptions of the exercise benefits. When we did the train the trainer, it was interesting because one, it changed the health of the people who actually did the training, but also for the people with disabilities, there was less pain, greater self-efficacy for exercise, and they got more social environmental support. So this just shows the reach. We've had a really big reach actually across the world. And you know, we've been doing train the trainers, and we've also moved to a virtual, totally virtual. So this just to give you some idea. And certainly if you're interested, you can get on their website for the Health Matters program. Not sure if I provided that. I think I didn't, but if you do Health Matters UIC, you will get to it on our website. The other program is called the We Walk program, and it's a technology intervention to improve the physical activity of adults with ID and their family caregivers, and it uses technology interventions in promoting physical activity in adults with ID. And what they're able to do is to track how much people are actually exercising with Fitbits and with messages back and forth. And it really addresses both the caregivers and the person with disabilities. And it's also done in conjunction with the Roybal Center on Health. Again, able to really have the resources of aging researchers as well. So moving to long-term home and community-based services and families, I'm using some of the state of the states data that's right now based in a University of Kansas. So I gave some statistics of where people live, both in California and the US. And you could see 74% live with family caregiver, people with IDD, 72% in the US, so not much different. And age of caregiver over 60 is 22% in California, 24% in the US. So it's still quite a number of families. And if you look at the family supported by IDD agencies, it's actually better in California than the rest of the US, 26% versus 11% in the US. So this gives you some idea of what's happening and why aging caregivers are so important in this whole thing. So what's the impact on families? Well, data has shown fewer opportunities for employment and retirement savings for these families. Restricted social networks, especially for the mothers, poor physical and mental health and stress for racial ethnic groups and behavior challenges. People, when the person with IDD has behavioral challenges, there's also, it has a bigger stress effect. This is out of research that Sandy Magana has done to look at African American and Latinos. There's more difficulties as families age, not surprising, but caring also has its positive aspects. And I can tell you that many families tell me that it provides 80 to 90% of families tell me that taking care of their son or daughter with disabilities provides meaning to their life. In many cases, the person with disabilities helping their family member. So we have many examples of reciprocal caregiving. But we also need to plan for future needs. And that's really a very important aspect. This is a picture of my mother and my sister. So believe it or not, my mother is 95. She looks pretty good. And that's my sister with disabilities. And she was part of the reasons I co-founded the Sibling Leadership Network. And siblings are the longest lasting relationship. So the Sibling Leadership Network has grown. It has over 5,500 siblings and supporters. 20, last I saw was 27 state chapters. We started it in 2007. And it is continuing to grow. One of the curriculums that we developed is called The Future Is Now. And that is one that you'll hear about what's happening with that one because we still have funding for this. It's been going for a while. So it's to develop future planning goals and document it and increase advocacy for supports. And we started with one of an efficacy trial where we had support groups and pre and post tests. And the outcomes that we had was that families made future plans. The issue was that many families did not make plans. And when they didn't make plans, there would be emergency placements and a lot of negative aspects. Particularly the financial stuff is gets complicated if you don't know how to do special needs trusts, etc. There's many issues with that. Caregivers experience less burden, including less worry about the future. That was really the important part. And the persons with ID had a greater voice in decisions about their life. So it really was an integration of person-centered, and, oh, it's missing a word, and family-centered philosophies. It's probably under the picture. Because it's not just person-centered, because what the family wants and what the person wants, you really have to take that in consideration. Sometimes different members of the families want different things. We had two siblings. There were actually three siblings. One of them had Down syndrome, and the two different siblings and the sibling with Down syndrome all disagreed about what they wanted for the future. Peer support is a very big part of it. We have trained the trainers that include people with IDD and family members. We do problem solving around family dynamics and family values, which is really important. And the focus includes both current and potential community supports. And we developed a virtual version. We tried to get funding for a virtual version, and people kept saying we got turned down, saying, people with IDD and their families can't do it. But then COVID came and they said, brilliant idea. So we've gotten funding to continue this kind of work. And I just wanted to mention that we're doing a virtual train the trainers with US Aging, which is the area agencies on aging. And we're going to be doing RFPs soon with different states. And states will be applying with US Aging if they want to be part of our virtual train the trainer initiative. In terms of IDD employment, you can see what percent have employment in integrated work, and you can see it's low, 20% in California, and 24% nationally. And then facility-based work, California doesn't have so much of that. It's 12% nationally. And 26% of people with cognitive disabilities age 18 to 64 in California live in poverty compared to 10% without cognitive disabilities. And we know that there's many retirement options, volunteering, recreational and health promotion activities, senior center participation, and continuing education. So those are just some examples. Roger Stancliffe has a very good program called Transition to Retirement. And it uses attending community group or volunteering. They use mentors, which are volunteers from the community. They do planning meetings, training of mentors. They have choice of activities and mentors and ongoing support. This was done in Australia originally. And it was a pretty successful program. We have end of life issues. And one is under recognition of health issues often happens and really a need for palliative care training. There's barriers to hospice care and often a lack of understanding of death and losses among the person with IDD. So there are a lot of training needs for staff. My own sister was very close to dying already a few times this year, and I'm her health proxy. And I was told to ask her whether she wanted palliative care or hospice care because the doctors were sure that she had cancer in the spine and they couldn't really do anything about it. She insisted she wanted palliative care and that she wasn't going to have hospice care and she wasn't going to die. It turned out that she did not have cancer in the end. It was due to osteoporosis, it was stress factors in her spine. So, but she wanted palliative care, which she got. I am going to talk about the need for bridging aging and disability, which is something that's been close to my heart. Here's a bridge in Chicago. I live right near there. It's a few blocks from this picture. And we know that both gerontology and the disability field can contribute to each other, and they often don't enough. There's so many common needs, and together there's such an efficiency of services. So here's some examples. And certainly, when ACL and the Administration for Community Living, both aging and disability were put under the same under the same umbrella. I mean, they have two separate parts of ACL. It gave a lot more opportunities, I think. We heard earlier about the National Task Group on ID and Dementia Practices, and that's been really effective. And they have a model training curriculum. They do family caregiver webinar series. They have online support newsletter for families. They have caregivers guide for families in Rhode Island. They have screening, support adaptation, access to a support network. Recently, they've done some work on autism and dementia, which is quite interesting. So it's really worth getting on their website. And I imagine there's probably some people on this webinar who are involved with the National Task Group because they've had a really big impact all over. And Matt Janicki, who really was his brainchild early on, has been able to get kind of into the federal government to get actual in RFPs to include people with IDD, and has been quite successful in getting IDD into a lot of the initiatives. The other thing I want to talk about is the Family Support Research and Training Center to bridge aging and IDD. I mean, bridging aging and disabilities, it's more general. And Sumitra Murthy at our end is the PI. I'm the co-PI on that. And it's a federal grant from National Institute on Independent Living, Disability, and Rehab Research. And it's really to bridge aging disability across the life course to advance family support, to promote promising and evidence-based informed practices, to generate new knowledge. We have a National Resource Center on Family Support to provide training and TA. And if you get on the website, and we have some really cool stuff on it. We have family support stories, podcasts, lots of resources. We have five research projects. One of them is the Virtual Futures Now. We're working with Brandeis, who are looking at national data sets around this topic. So there's a lot of sort of wonderful resources on this site. So looking to the future, we have, let me just go back here. We have greater use of technology and universal design to address age-related changes. So there's a lot of really cool projects that are looking at that. The University of Colorado had a project specifically around IDD and technology. I was part of that. They don't have that particular one anymore. But also you will see in the general around physical disabilities, there are centers specifically looking at technology and how to use it for age-related changes. And we're seeing more and more, we're seeing remote use of remote technologies so that people can live more independently. Many states are using that now with IDD. And so we're seeing more and more. I did not mention, but we are part of a project that the National Association of Councils on Developmental Disabilities has that's on bridging aging and disabilities in IDD. And they're working with 17 states, and California is actually one of those states. And it's all to do to bridge work between aging and disability. But they had a wonderful webinar last week on housing options and using technology. And so there's a lot of really cool projects. And one of those housing projects was in San Jose. Really interesting housing. Another big area is transportation assistance, especially in rural areas. But I know where my sister lives. It's south of Chicago, southwest, near Joliet, Illinois. It's called New Lenox. There is no Uber, no way for her to get any transportation assistance, because she needs an accessible van, and there is no system out there. So when I want to invite her to my house for something, then staff has to come with her with their special van to come and have her come, say, for holidays to my house. There's a real pressure on the system and families with a lack of workforce and community capacity, because what we have is, as you probably know, first of all, the personal assistance that we rely on, because so many people do live at home, and actually so few the people who are getting supports and to get family support in the home need personal assistance, workers, et cetera. And sometimes it's really hard to find them, or they don't get enough hours. Their pay is not very good. So And if you look that the National Core Indicators out of Asia Human Service Research Institute has a lot of data on workforce. There's also a technical assistance center on workforce that's both in aging and disabilities. So that is a really big issue. And community capacity, there are big waiting lists, especially for residential services. And so you can see that as another big area. And there's a growing recognition of supportive decision making and interdependence. So we talk about having more independence. That's often a goal. But we're all interdependent. And so we really now talk about interdependence because none of us are totally dependent, totally independent. And especially as you get older, and sometimes it's reciprocal. And there's a growing recognition of supportive decision making. And, for example, I'm a health proxy. I gave that example. But many people maybe can't make the decision totally by themselves, but with help, and they can pick sometimes who they would like to have help them out. So this is another big area. And then we need research for better ways to bridge aging and IDD. Thank you. And now I open it up for questions.
Thank you so much. That was amazing. We do have some questions. One is just a what how is family supported by IDD agencies defined?
How is family support by agency? Well, for one, the often there's waivers for home-based support services program, and they offer family support. And actually, families can actually be the paid personal assistant workers. So many families do partake of that. That's one example. The Charting the Lifespan, which is out of the University of Missouri initiative, they emphasize not just paid supports, but the use of informal supports as well. But yeah, I like to see actually formal supports in place because there's been a lot of emphasis on families taking care, and I feel that sometimes it's not really fair to families to expect that they're going to take care, and especially for women that are, or men, but usually it's women that are continuing to work, and for them to have the person with disability at home, sometimes it can be really difficult. They don't get enough family support to be able to do that.
That's a good point. And when families do provide services and supports and are paid for it, at least in California, I'm not sure elsewhere, that support is tax-free, which is great because it increases family income. But then because they're not paying taxes, they're not contributing to Medicare and paying those payroll taxes, and sometimes don't have enough quarters to qualify for Medicare when they get older, and then are left without the Social Security and Medicare that they might need. Do you think that there are policies around family caregivers that should evolve, or how do we manage that?
That's a really good point. Truthfully, I hadn't thought of that so much, but that is a good one. And maybe that's something that should be incorporated. But I don't know if families want to pay taxes and want to pay that. So that may be a question of, if there's a way that they could do that. Because if they make it a real career, if that becomes their career, that is problematic.
Yeah, and then sometimes, you can't fire your mother if she's dedicated her whole life to you, even if she can't do the work anymore. So that, it prevents the caregivers from retiring as well, or people getting the support they need.
I can give you an example.
Yeah.
I sort of hate to use this, but I did myself some interviews when we started some of this work, because we looked at paid caregivers. We had a study about that. And it was a very poor family. And it was a great aunt that took over somebody who had IDD. And I interviewed him, and one of my students interviewed her. But she was basically using that money to support herself, because otherwise she couldn't really afford to take this gentleman into her house. So she was doing a good thing. However, when I interviewed him, he was getting no support at all, other than in the home. But he said he wanted a job. He was hanging out with drug dealers out in the street every day. And he complained to me about not having a chance to bring girlfriends into the house and things like that. So I could see the other side. On the other hand, I didn't blame this mom, because she really needed the money, or this great aunt. So, and she was doing a good thing by having the person in her house. So there are sometimes challenges, but on the other hand, it is so important that if families want to do that support, that they get that support. And we had a study, and we didn't realize so many people would be getting paid, so many of the caregivers. So we had a typical, actually remodeled off a study that was done in California, where we asked questions about how they feel about their personal support worker. And it turned out to be, how do you feel about your mother? That really kind of bombed. It wasn't a very good survey, because half the people was their mother, and it was very awkward to say, how do you feel about your mother? So.
Interesting. We have a question about, are there ways to engineer a soft handoff from aging family to the next step, a little at a time, instead of a sudden emergency? I see two things happen. One is that, there's a crisis in the caregiver, and that, of course, that's more likely to happen as caregivers age, or the caregiver develops their own health problems, even early dementia or advanced dementia or physical problems that make it more difficult for them to provide the same level of care and advocacy, and the care they can provide gradually declines. And if the parents are experiencing dementia, people with dementia remember how things were and don't tend to recognize that there's an issue that needs to be solved, so they don't ask for help, and they don't identify it as a problem, and so things can get pretty bad before somebody even recognizes a problem or has the authorization to intervene. Do you have any thoughts about how we can be more proactive about that inevitable transition from parent care to another kind of care, how we can put supports in sooner?
Well, that's why we do the futures now as one example, but there's other ways to do the future planning. Ours is kind of an intensive kind of a group thing of really having family looking at their dynamics, but also case coordinators or can also talk to families and do one-on-one, which some people do. I know the ARC of US has, they have a whole website about family future planning. I don't know how much they're doing of it now, but they had developed that. At one time, we were involved with that. And there are a lot of the other initiatives are basically having the parents fill out something and then talk to the person with IDD, et cetera. But that's a beginning to at least get people are reluctant because it makes people anxious to think about that. And that's part of the reason that they don't like even coming to our training. A lot of people wouldn't come because they don't even want to think about it. Because who wants to think about when they won't be able to take care, or when they're going to be ill, or that's why so few people have, lifetime insurance. We know that. It's just something that makes families very anxious.
There was another question about maybe we should put maybe we should make it mandatory to put this into individual program plans, because many underrepresented folks need access to a more dignified transition.
That's a really good point. to do that. I mean, we do that in the high schools. They do the planning. The person-centered planning is kind of built in, or at least
Right.
supposed to be built in. And in terms of planning for young adulthood. So as people get older, they really need to, and they can start earlier, but they need to start thinking about those things. And involving the siblings, is if they're siblings, is really important, because I can tell you many bad stories about siblings who ended up taking over, not knowing much about anything,
Absolutely.
about the person with disability. Maybe they live in a different state. And then, something happens with the parents. Suddenly they don't know what to do. Nora Fox Handler and Katie Arnold both have stories about that, and the family dynamics of that,
Yeah.
and what happens.
Yes, so many things to think about, and I appreciate your laying it out there so clearly for us. Thank you so much, Dr. Heller.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.